Blog Talk Radio.
We've got film, and we've got psychology. When we put the two together, we've got filmcology. Each week, we will look at the psychology of the characters in film, and it gives us something lovely to think about. So, let's get started. Filmcology is now.
Good morning, everybody, and it's Thursday. So today we're doing the movie Aliens. This is the second in the series of the Alien film anthology, and we get to see where the characters have traversed to from the first one. And I've got like a spoiler alert, they don't all make it. I know, it's so sad. I really miss Yaphet Kotto and all the rest of them. They were just, they're such key personalities. To me, it was just something really interesting. But anyway, such as it was, we continue with Lieutenant Ripley, whose cunning ways are what got her through that horrific detail of encountering some strange xenomorph, as they called her, called the creature in this new movie. Okay, some things that I noticed from the very beginning of the show, for both shows, Alien and Aliens. In Alien, one of the things that I noticed was, as you come from the beginning of the show, the very beginning, both shows actually start in the beginning of sort of you're in the cockpit area, excuse me, where everybody's looking at you're sort of looking at the area where everybody works when they're driving the ship, and you see the automated sort of, well, it was giving you the impression that the ship or the shuttle are, you know, they almost seem empty, but it's still alive and there's movement going on. They have this little jingly moving thing that is swirling around, sort of giving you the impression that it's not just some empty room in a back lot, so that you understand that you're in space. And so we have that in both movies in the very beginning, although in Aliens it shows up later when the ship is going to the rock again. But the thing that was really distinctive to me is when we come through that cockpit and then you go through the halls and then it opens up to the room where everybody is laying in stasis. They're, the big sleep. The first movie, Alien, everything is so sterile and it's so white. It's just almost blinding, the white and sterile process. It's just kind of interesting to me how clean and white everything looks. And then the next movie comes in and you start the same way. You come in and then you see there's just everything in the cockpit is covered with some kind of shiny debris. And so to me, it's very interesting that after you kind of come from the cockpit in the area in the shuttle, that everything's all sort of dark and the debris, then you see her laying in stasis, and everything's dark. I mean, it's so strikingly different and dark that. So anyway, I just got a funny text from my cousin Ronnie, and I know you're out there. Thanks, cuz. I love you. And so so those two things to me are already setting us up for what we're headed for. The first one is almost like things are so innocent and there's nothing really tainted. The second one pretty much telling us that things aren't going to be probably pleasant. I guess that's the best way for me to put it. So then we start out the film not with everybody but with one person, and it's Lieutenant Ripley with the cat. A salvage team finds her, and it's 57 years after the whole event took place, because her ship has drifted outside of the main limitations of what they normally look for. So then we come into how they're setting us up in the movie from Ripley's point of view. She wants to know immediately what happened to her daughter. And it's interesting that her daughter turns out to be 11 years old. And we know that the show is going to have some theme about motherhood. You know, how is motherhood, the motherhood's been taken away from Sigourney Weaver, from Lieutenant Ripley, and how do we deal with that? You know, why would anybody direct and even talk about this daughter unless it was going to be a major issue for Lieutenant Ripley? So then she learns that her daughter died within a year of her being found. So it's just like just shy of being able to actually see her daughter, who now would be an older woman. And they use Sigourney Weaver's real mother for the shot. They have a picture of her real mother smiling. But that is, of course, intimated as if that was her daughter, which I like that little play that the director used. And then we get into the big, who's responsible for this whole situation? And surprisingly, the company, the big evil company that was responsible for all the deaths in the first place and this whole debacle, they cast Lieutenant Ripley under the bus for that one, because they're not going to stand up and say, oh, it was really our fault, don't worry, we're going to not hold it against you, but you're quote unquote unfit. If you see that scene, remember this scene where we're in the boardroom, there's more things that, I mean, there's. I just hope that you guys are listening to or watching all these things that have to do with the gender. We go into this boardroom and everybody's dressed in a male business suit. And I say male business suit because that's basically, they're wearing the basic uniform of the male business suit that we see in current times. You have the tie, you have the white shirt, and you have the coat, so the whole suit. And as they go around the conference room table, you see this one woman who she's sitting back and she's smoking a cigarette the way we often see somebody who's of some upper echelon in a corporation or a company where the big wigs can do whatever they want, and it's usually some quote-unquote good old boy, but it's a woman. And she looks very male-oriented. Her hair is not cut short and butch, so to speak, but she just, there's nothing about her when you look at her initially that would indicate that she's either male or female. And because she's in the male business suit, she almost seems sort of like a male. She doesn't have the quote-unquote, like, typical, beautiful, woman-esque-looking face. And I'm saying that because of, well, most American films, you know, women have to look like a Baywatch girl or be blonde with blue eyes and have that Barbie doll look. But she doesn't have any of that. She just sort of looks, well, she almost has an androgynous view about her, how she appears. And then the other woman that's on the panel that we see in the conference room, we only see the back of her head. And the only reason that we even assume that she's a woman, because we never see her face, is her hair is in a do-up, a hairstyle that's an updo, and it's twisted and pinned up, like some woman might wear out to an event. It's awfully strange. And she's obviously, from what we can see of her, also in this business man's male suit. And then the other woman in the room that we see is Lieutenant Ripley, who's just in some dungarees, and she's trying to face these people that are basically putting all the details down to her anonymously blowing up a ship and all these people are dead, and based on some creature that they don't have, they supposedly, nobody knows about, it's not a known creature, nobody's ever heard of it. And so she has nothing that she can leverage or fight with this creature. And the whole point for them is, we didn't get what we want, so you're just nothing but an impediment to what we sent you all out there for in the first place, even though it was under the guise of some kind of mining ship. The other thing that we see is they don't, what you would think if she was this horrible person who blew up this expensive ship and, you know, and actually did all this stuff as if she were a typical criminal, stole a ship, killed everybody on board, and then decided to come back with some horrific story. I can't think of any society that wouldn't have put that person away or executed them. So why would the company just go, well, we're not going to, you know, kill you or maim you or whatever, but you are, quote unquote, again, unfit to drive a particular ship anymore. You're no longer able to serve as a flight person. And so it doesn't make any sense. I mean, already if you're following all the cues, everything is talking about this woman in a way that she's totally dependent on them for her living. There's nothing there for her. There's no stock, there's no nothing. Her family's gone, so she's sort of indigent, and yet out of the grace of their heart, the company is going to allow her to live. And she's going to have to go through psychometric evaluation, which is the psychology work. It's kind of an interesting way to call it, psychometric, and that's probably to indicate that psychology becomes a science where it's all about the numbers and, you know, some assessment is done on your body and your brain, and you either make this number or you don't, and then it determines what your state of mind is, what disorder you have, blah, blah, blah. So then we get to that point, and then Sigourney is just doing grunt work. And then we get to the big rock where things are taking place at the very same place where Sigourney first encountered the alien with her first in the first movie with the rest of the crew. And then we also hear, if you got to see the right version, that the company or somebody from the company sent off some terraformer people to go off in search of a specific area, which happened to be where this ship from the first movie still is. And what we see there, the next thing that we see that's parallel to the first movie, the dad is just like, let's go in there, let's go check it out. And the wife is like, don't you think we should call this in? Mind you, they have their little boy and their little girl in the back of their car, and the wife just sort of acquiesces. Like, she's almost, you get just the slight hint that she just sort of defers to his over exuberance, and then they go into the ship. And the difference also is they're walking outside, which in the first movie you couldn't. You needed the spacesuits. And they go in, and then you see the little kids with the little girl Newt saying to her brother, who actually is her real brother in real life, that, you know, mom and dad have been gone a while. You know, and then mom and dad come back, and then the face hugger is on the exuberant male who just won't wait, won't take a better protocol, just like the first guy, Kane, who just, we have to just get in there, we have to go, and he's the one who ends up with a face hugger just like the first movie. So now that's where we are at the start of the movie, where Sigourney gets pulled in by the company, and she's pulled in by the company to help out, but if you think about it, you know, they want to still get a hold of this specimen. If Sigourney gets killed in the meantime, well, that's just a nice convenience for the company if you think about it. So here we are starting with the new movie. We do have a caller on. We'll see if the caller wants to join in. Hello? No? Okay. Okay, the caller's not going to join in. Okay. So anyway, as we're going through this movie, Sigourney's now faced with going back to a place that, you know, why would anybody want to go back there? But it has to do with her sense of honor and ethics and the thought of any other human being having to go through what Kane went through and all the other crew that she lost in the first movie. She rethinks going for that very reason, just thinking about these families that are there. And she understands that there could be, the whole place could be overrun with these things because Kane had said that there were thousands and thousands of eggs there. And the colony that's on this rock is the actual population. It was listed as 153. Okay, so now we have the military, we have the company, and they need this woman to take them back to the ship. That doesn't make sense whatsoever. And that's another reason why you have to think the company is sort of hoping to kill two birds with one stone. And sadly, they involved the military okay, let's face it, in America, the military have often been co-opted into missions that they didn't understand were not about just simply helping to save other people. So the military is, unbeknownst to them, co-opted into this big mission to go find out what's happened to these colonies. Now we go back to the stasis, and we do see slightly light, but the stasis is still never as clean and sterile as back in the first movie, where everything starts out, where we're reminded how innocent everything started. You know, there's this constant cast of things being slightly darker. And then Sigourney is thrust in the company of soldiers who are irreverent for whatever reason, probably because they're soldiers. I don't recall when my brother was a soldier, him talking about everyone being sort of super respectful when they talk to each other when they're out, when they're deployed somewhere. And nothing that we ever see about soldiers being deployed to the front line ever indicates that they're all real polite and drinking tea with each other. Yeah, they say a lot of things that might possibly be hurtful, like when they're saying in the room, oh, you know, we have to deal with these blanking colonists again. And Sigourney is incensed by this, and then she gets to encounter another android. So we're really starting to get back into the exact same problem that we were in with the first movie. The problems are that women, as far as Sigourney Weaver is concerned, women aren't really at the top of anything. We have the military, and the women are, quote-unquote, in the future, taken as the same, because we have Vasquez, and we have Ferrero, and there's another woman, and they're, what's interesting is their hair is cut short and butch. None of the female soldiers is given a look that's more quote-unquote feminine. They don't have long hair. There's not ponytails. There's not curls or anything like that. Everybody's hair is cut short. So they're sort of trying to say that women that are on the military are going to be just as tough and exactly the same as the males in the military. There would be no difference. And apparently they feel the only way that can happen is to make the woman look exactly like the male. And, of course, she has to have all the built-up muscles, except for the flight commander, Farrell, the one who drives the main pilot. She's really thin. But the rest of the women that are in there in the military are thick and basically muscular. And then they even refer to Sigourney Weaver as Snow White in the very beginning when they encounter her. Like, she's just a fluff cake. She's just a woman almost compared to what they are. Like, they're not really women. So there's a lot of weird gender things going on in Aliens that was also going on in Alien. Even, and, you know, I just want to remind you, we're looking at science fiction. This is fiction. This is the future. And yet, even in the future, we have a problem with women being able to be equal. You can't be a woman and be equal in the military. You have to be a man. In the conference room with the males all in the business suits, you can't be a woman and be in the big business or part of the company. You still have to be male-like. You have to look like a male for you to be in a male position. And the one woman who has hairdo like that so distinctly like something from evening wear, the big updo, she is completely defaced. We don't see her face at all. we don't see anything about her except that hairstyle, which would indicate she's a woman, so that you understand that, yeah, women are at that level, but not really. And so as we go further into this whole thing where Sigourney is now tasked to deal with this military who is basically all male, and then she's forced to deal with the company who's in the form of one person, Burke. And the company is represented by this sniveling, cowardly, what's the word for people like that? Somebody who basically, just sniveling, snake who would kill you as soon as look at you if you weren't looking at him. Just that really creepy personality. And he represents the company. And just basically like the company was in the first movie, but now we have him incarnate in a human being, not the android, which is the big switcheroo that we have, so that you're not trusting. We've already learned not to trust the android, so the whole thing we're seeing, Sigourney doesn't trust the android, but we normally trust humans. Now the company has stepped it up to prove that as human beings, the company is still corrupt. So then we go to this rock. Everything's all ever, nothing's the way it should be. They get there, and they're looking for the colonists who are all gone. They're just, what's interesting is the name of that colony is called Hadley's Hope. It's like the hope for what? I don't know if that's a play. I have to say I haven't researched it more. If that's a play on Halloween, because I don't, well, maybe it isn't, but I know that for Halloween, the original movie, Haddonfield was the name of the town in Halloween. But I do know that a lot of science fiction directors and horror directors, they have a lot of fun by referring back to other science fiction and Halloween movies, not Halloween movies, but just horror films. So I just find it really intriguing about that, Hadley's Hope. And I'll probably figure out a little bit further down the road as I study these movies further. But anyway, so we have Hadley's Hope, which has about 158 people. We see that the kids are running around in Hadley's Hope, this operational place, and there's big doors, which I think is really interesting when the terraformers are in their buggies and they go and leave the complex. There's huge doors that open and shut for you to get into the complex, and I'm wondering to myself, what were the big doors for? I mean, yeah, the atmosphere is a little bit windy and possibly wet and all that, but if that was really an issue, how come there wasn't more, why wasn't there covering over the top of it? It just is really odd. But anyway, so that's also giving you an idea that there might be something that people might know, but yet the people aren't there yet. We don't see them afraid of anything on that planet yet. And so we go there, we go inside, they see all the damage that's going on, and the only one who's sort of reacting like there's something terrifying or frightful is Sigourney, who is the woman. And I'm going to say she's the woman because she represents the female entity, because she doesn't look like a man. She isn't particularly dressed like a man. She's just, she's still quote-unquote alien, just like she was in the first movie. She was alien because she was intelligent and she was at an upper level of the flight crew. She was third in command, I believe. And that was just that's just unheard of because she's a woman. Now she's an alien. She sort of doesn't belong. And she's lost her little girl. Then we find a little girl. Little girl that's squirreling around into the ducts. And she happens to be about the same age as Sigourney Weaver's real daughter who died a year ago. And as a woman, not as a little girl. So what was taken away from Sigourney is now replaced in this new child who is like a wild child, or I can't remember the name of the child that they found in the woods back in the early 1900s or 1800s, and who was just, she looked like a wild animal. They could never really get her to assimilate into society. Well, now we have this representation, this little girl named Newt. And nobody can figure out what's going on, despite the fact that Sigourney has given them all the details. And now, as they go looking for the colonists, we have this, the head of the military is, interestingly enough, very weak man. He's weak in that he has no real decent experience. So he's ineffective. We have the company man who is almost, the nervousness in this snake-like bit about him is telling you that he's just like festering for something. He's already waiting to get something. And it's just, he's making us uncomfortable the whole time. And yet you can tell that he's wanting something. It's not just, okay, yeah, you guys handle it. He's got to be right there to guide things, kind of like Ash, the android, did in the first one, to sort of guide the situation so that they can get this specimen. And they all go down, not all of them, but the military guys, they all go down into this complex to find the colonists. And they instead find, well, the dead colonists that have all been impregnated by all these creatures, and then they come out of the woodwork, and they start killing the military people. And so now we go back to where Sigourney takes the lead. So then the alien is rising in different ways. There's the creature alien that's rising because there's more than what we saw from the first one. And now there's the alien, which is Sigourney Weaver, who takes charge and control of the little rover vehicle to try to save the military guys. And interestingly enough, the company man is very excited for her to go ahead and take over, even because the military guy who he got, one who was so weak, would not have been experienced in this situation, his command is taken out of his hand at the last minute, so Sigourney can just do her thing about just wanting to save the world. Well, I'm sure the company man is thinking that somebody that's going to be saved is going to be impregnated with something that he can take back to the company, and they could be overjoyed and probably kill off everyone. Who knows? So we go down there. They're trying to get away. And the only time that you even have any kind of sense that there's something between anyone is when Drake gets killed and Vasquez, who was his partner, she doesn't care. She wants to get him. She wants to get Drake, and yet he's dead. I mean, he's dying. Then they're completely wounded down to just a few military people and this alien Sigourney Weaver and her child, and then some other creature that's making all these creatures. We come down to the crux of this movie, that there's a mother somewhere making all these creatures, and then here's this mother who's trying to save her creatures, Lieutenant Ripley, and then the Mother Queen, and we finally encounter the Mother Queen after Sigourney's newest baby is taken away from her. And she has to save her baby because she lost her baby and she's still trying to get her back. There's that whole psychological theme that's going on about this mother. When I first wanted to see this movie, when it first came out, I would say my boyfriend, but I guess that's what would be the traditional word. But anyway, he's my lover. Yeah, I was trying to get him to go see the movie, and I'm just going to tell you who he was so that you can probably understand where his point of view was. He had fought in Vietnam, just like my older brother. He was the same age as my oldest brother. Yes, I like him older and already marinated. And so my oldest brother fought in Vietnam, just like my lover. And my lover's, he was actually in like a special unit that sort of like SEALs, but it was through the Army. And so he was in a special unit that had to go in and different areas and do things that other people didn't do. And when he came back from Vietnam, he was clearly disturbed about everything that was happening to him. He had explained to me at one point that when he first came back from Vietnam, every time he used to drive cars, but when somebody, he'd be in traffic, and if somebody honked the horn, he would get really scared and jump out of his car and just roll under any vehicle that was parked on the side of the road or anything. He just had the whole PTSD issue huge. I didn't really understand it because I was 14 years younger than him, and I'm not as wise as I am today with psychology. But so this was somebody who fought over there, and he saw all those horrors in Vietnam with the death of lots of families and soldiers, and which included mothers and their daughters and sons, the whole thing. So when I'm asking him to go see this movie about aliens, the first thing he said is, I don't want to go see a movie where two mothers are just trying to protect their babies. I remember looking at him like, are you insane? I said, it's a monster. Because there's where my head was at from the first time I saw Aliens, because it disturbed me. Even though I know now the real monster wasn't the creature, it was actually the company. And so that was the first time I had any clue what was going on into the movie, but I just thought Glenn was a bit of a hippie, of course. You know, he's just anti-establishment by this point in his life. And, you know, the whole long hair, John Lennon glasses. He was an artist and a landscaper, a gardener. Just, you know, all this, the little, almost like the way everybody was in the 60s when I was a little girl. And so I didn't go see the movie with him. I ended up going with another guy. But the movie did turn out to be two mothers that are pitted against each other. And they aren't pitted against each other because they chose to just come in and get all big and bad with each other. It's because of the company. And from the perspective of Sigourney Weaver or Lieutenant Ripley, this creature was just the epitome of everything evil and horrific. And you don't really, I mean, if you really look closely, you start to see that the mother or the queen creature, she looks at Sigourney Weaver with the same point of view based on her body language and how she's just like, Sigourney totally blew up all of her children, all of them. And so now she's coming after Sigourney Weaver and this little girl, and she wants to kill the little girl for Sigourney Weaver. It's like, you took out my babies, now I'm going to take out your one. Even if we start to look at the weight of it, is that equal, one child, this and that? It's all messed up. It's all messed up. So now we have this whole thing in science fiction where we have the alien from the first series. She gets transmuted into the second movie, and she's not just an alien as a woman who is smart and, you know, can survive and actually is at an upper level. They take away her level, they take away her child, and they give her another child, and they make her a mother. So now we have to look at the sort of, which I think is kind of almost hilarious, the evil monster alien that is a mother, the female. We're looking at the whole gender thing about what this company, I mean, what our society is sort of saying about mothers and how mothers are more concerned about their children. And maybe that's why they're so alien to the male species in our society, because once the woman gets impregnated with her daughter or her son, her child, all of a sudden the male seems inconsequential. And even in this movie, it's interesting that the males always seem inconsequential. It's all about the two mothers. And somebody's fantasy about turning the alien female into an alien female that fights another alien female. So that's what we got for this movie. I'm not quite sure if anybody else wants to talk about it or if they have some other ideas about it, but basically this is what we're looking at, continued issues about gender. And these issues aren't coming from the future. These issues are coming from the here and now, in the way that we see ourselves, the way that our society basically looks at women, and the way our society believes women have to be if they're going to ever be equal. You can't, it's like just a basic psychological understanding that somebody doesn't have to be the same to be equal in their capabilities. And that's something that we all should be questioning. How come I have to be a man? I mean, how come I have to be castrated to be a man? Or how come I have to, yeah, how come I have to give up all of me to be equal to a man in my ability to do the same job? Oh, we have a caller calling in. Hold on one moment. See if they would like to join in. Hello, this is Somcology. Would you like to join in the conversation?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Tell me what it is that you wanted to say.
Well, yeah, I actually had some questions about the movie in general.
Okay.
As to, well, not the movie in general, but the whole, you know, concept of aliens, you know, this particular series, of course, is, you know, an example, but there are a lot of that kind of, I'm interested in what, you know, scary, monstrous aliens represent to us psychologically as far as, you know, why you've got to have some horrible, overpowering monsters that logically no feeble human, no matter what their, you know, intelligence or weaponry or whatever, would be, you know, logically able to overcome. But, of course, American movies usually have to end up with the hero / heroine triumphing against, you know, impossible odds. And what does that represent to us, you know, socially? What do we get as a release or going to see, you know, something like this of the impossible, you know, that we can't overcome in our own lives? Does that give us some kind of, you know, subliminal feeling that I can identify with this hero heroine and therefore I'm able to triumph over the horrible, oppressed life that I am actually living? It's the first question, and the second question would involve, it's concerning why Americans in particular seem, even though it's, you know, portrayed in film quite often, are seem consciously unable to accept the total evil, soulless nature of capitalism.
Ah.
You know, as in the evil company.
Yes.
Yeah, you can just leave the second question for later, but I'm kind of interested in what aliens, you know, what in general that represents to us. I totally agree with the whole female, you know, portrayal thing, that we are actually some kind of monsters, possibly from the male perspective, and that, you know, that. But just as, you know, humans, what do the portrayal of evil as opposed to, you know, benign aliens, not even evil, but obviously.
Well, it's different.
Total
it's
enemy
something
bent on survival. You know, what is that? I'm sorry.
Well, it's different. It's something outside of us. And again,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of on that theme that you can't be different. You cannot be
mm-hmm.
different, or you're
mm-hmm.
alien. And if you
uh-huh.
come from that point of view, then who's determining who's alien? Well,
uh-huh.
Clearly it's the good old boy male network. Because, you know, woman, if you don't believe that's what's going on, then why must all the characters be male-looking? Why must
right.
all the characters dress like the male costume, the male uniform? Everything is telling you that anything that is not
pseudo-male.
Looking
yeah.
like the good old boy is alien, i.e. the monster that, you know, was minding its own business, and we came
right.
out and decided it was an evil threat, so it must be completely annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, when I first encountered it, I just wanted it to be obliterated, too. I had enough nightmares over that. But, yeah, it really is that you're different, so you're evil. I mean, we can look back in America, and guess what? Slaves who built a ship to come over here and do what? No, they didn't even have anything to do with America. As far as I know of, I've never heard of anything where the people of Africa decided to build a ship and, you know, come over to America. I don't recall anywhere in history where that kind of even exploration was taking place. And even if you want to say, oh, well, they didn't have the technology, or if you want to say they didn't have the brains, maybe they had the brains to understand that they had enough trouble in their own country without going to another country and deciding they wanted to be enslaved and annihilated because they weren't seen as the same. They were clearly different. So different is expendable. You know,
yeah,
how they
well,
said in the first
those
movie,
primarily the people that were
in
even within Africa, you know, different groups, one more powerful group captured their, you know, unlike, in other words, another tribe or group people and sold them to white slavers.
Well, sure.
You know,
but that's my whole point.
So what you're saying is that since aliens obviously represent
the greater prejudice and discrimination that goes about for people who just can't accept anything outside themselves.
Well, right. So my question is, what are you trying to say? I mean, I tend to agree with that picture that in American society, probably a lot of world societies, and I've read some psychological surveys recently of this, you know, identification with the group and fitting into the group, and that people, all those who are not part of the group and not whatever, are alien and the enemy, so that even all of the various religious conflicts around the world, when people are questioned exactly, it's usually not concerned with actual beliefs, but us and them. And then when people are divided into groups in psychological experiments, okay, you're in group randomly, you guys are group A, B, C, immediately people start to view people of the non-self group as evil, inferior, have shortcomings, see bad things, and start to identify with and see good things of their own particular group. But as far as for aliens itself, does that help those of us who are, I don't know, help, but appeal to those of us that are don't fit in as able to see something that is even, you know, more strange that we're able to triumph over? Or is this a movie that's basically appealing to more the status quo of, okay, you're divergent, you're a freak, and you should die, you know, because you're not part of
the
norm.
I mean, psychologically, as far as you must die because you're different. See, that it still comes down to who's setting the definition.
Well, right.
Know, and to me, it's just like you're saying. I mean, I remember when I first took psychology in high school, one of the things that our teacher talked about is when you first walk into a room with people and you don't really know the people, the first thought that what they found out, I guess they tested this, that most people think that everyone else in the room is idiotic, or not really idiotic, but we think that they're not as smart as we are. Basically, we don't see them as equal as us. We look at them as below us. And
when
I think that's some
room?
Kind of... Huh?
You're talking about the person that comes into
the
a group?
The person who walks into a room and they don't know everybody in the room, they're this is like a weird self-preservation thing.
Okay,
they assume that everybody in the room is not as intelligent as they are.
I have to question that because...
Well, anyway,
the study
said that as soon as...
Well, no, I understand that. I understand that.
Yeah, but as soon as they get to know more of the people in the room, then they change their thought process.
Well, right. No, I can understand that. I can understand that study. I'm just saying that my personal life experience from, like, tiny childhood, every time, and then I know other people like this too, automatically if you come into a room, and it's different if it's, you know, just one other person, but if you come into a room that's a group and they're already there, you presume that they're some kind of cohesiveness, superiority, you are the inferior alien, and everyone there automatically hates you and does not want to let you enter. I don't think that that's from my experience. I never ever experienced the feeling of coming into any kind of group and feeling superior to that group.
Well, Nancy, and you also have a different mindset.
I know. So that's why I'm just, really interesting to me that there's actually a study that says the opposite.
I know.
I thought it was weird. I can hardly imagine it.
Yeah, I thought about that, and I remember thinking in the beginning, like, I don't think that way about people. I mean, I was immediately defensive about that because I thought to myself, and I don't know where they've done with the study. I mean, that's been 20-something, 30-something, I don't know how many years, 40-something years ago, whatever. But was it conducted in colleges, for instance? Huh?
Was it conducted
what?
In colleges, college students?
I don't know. You know, it was a high school psychology class. You know, what level of, you know, so most likely nobody was worried about studies to the level that they are at my graduate level of schooling. So,
right. Yeah.
And where,
so
you know, where we would actually cite a study and give you some idea. But I thought it was actually embarrassing from my point of view. Like, would I actually think that? And I actually would go into rooms, and my self-preservation, I remember thinking things like, you know, they're not all so perfect. You know, they're not better than me. That's what I used to think, which is sort of the same thing. And then I was the kind of person that sort of, you know, I don't know, I think that my self-esteem was pretty low. When I would go into group situations. And until I started to not care. And most of the time when I walked into a room, I got too much attention. So, you know, my thought process, even when my self-esteem was low, was to try to find a corner to hide in. And when my self-esteem was at a much higher level, I was also trying to find a corner to hide in because I just don't care for that much attention, no matter what level my self-esteem is in. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for me, I guess the more that I developed my own personality and the more, secure I became, then the more attention I got.
Yeah.
People are really drawn to you when you're secure in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I
just finally just stopped going to a lot of parties.
Yeah. My opinion of that kind of study is that I'm just guessing, but I'm... My opinion is that the kind of people that they called to send into group were, I would say, people of privilege, people who already
college students,
you know, already have, you know, an established sense of ego that, you know, nobody's going to come on me. So, of course, you know, just, yeah, and it probably is a self-preservation thing. Maybe that is, I don't know. You know, a healthy attitude,
Well, there's clearly a difference.
It's taken me a lifetime to just barely, you know, overcome the exact opposite of, you know, feeling. Because I will say that from childhood, whenever I walked into any kind of a group, classroom, the bus, anything, I felt exactly like one of those monsters from Aliens. And I always did feel like I was the center of the tension because people were, you know, would automatically think, you know, there's a strange, horrible fucking monster that we hate and we have to kill it. You know, so to me, that's like, you know, when a strange thing, person, being, you know, enters the group, it's almost like, it seems like, this is the
primitive
human response. Attack that which
is
different.
Maybe it's the type of group, because when you're talking about people getting onto a bus, that's an actual pseudo group. There's not really a cohesion whatsoever in that group. Maybe there was a type of group, but that was not communicated clearly to us. It's all really great stuff, and I wish I could talk about the second question because you just are bringing up fabulous psychological issues. But I'm sorry, folks, we're just out of time, and I hope that you will join us in the next movie in the series. It's Alien 3, or Aliens, The Third Power. And I know. Okay, it, you know, I hope, no, you're probably aliened out, but there's really something important that I'm building on what's going on here, and I hope that you join us next Thursday at 11 o'clock.
And, you have to restudy that, that one.
Yeah, I really appreciate you calling in, Nancy. It just, it's nice to be able to talk to somebody about it instead of just sort of talking to myself. But anyway, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, luckily I was here. I'm really, you know, I'm interested in your insights. They're
okay.
Really fantastic. So.
I'm interested in yours and everyone else's. I just wish people would call in and, you know, come on, give me your 2 cents. You know, do you think what I'm saying is hogwash or not? Just, you know, get, you know, you got a voice, use it. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, it's hard to catch in time. I'm sure probably... You know, it's a timing thing. People would if they.
I mean, when's the right time?
Themselves.
Who knows? Yeah. Okay. Well,
yeah. You
take care. Thank you, and I'll talk to you in a bit.
Okay. Thanks for your efforts.
Okay.
And
thanks,
your info.
Nancy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.